Do we have a number on the Yash troops that you're looking at? And which division, which regiment, like that?
The total number of US
troops
right now?
The 82nd or?
Yeah, I don't have that handy. Could find out, but I'm not handy.
I don't have a figure at this moment. Part of it is that it's very fluid. I'll be there for 2 weeks and then they leave and then a new group comes in. I do know that there are about 70 intelligence personnel in Mindanao, U.S. intelligence. Well, there was an interview with a former U.S. ambassador, Richard Doty, who left his post or was reassigned several months ago. But before he left, he was asked, by a media person, we heard that there are 70 U.S. spies in Mindanao, or that, you said this in an interview. And he said, No, I never said there were... I never said that. If you read the transcript, what I said is that there are personnel who are doing intel ops fusion. Intel ops fusion is not spying. It's going to the area, gathering information, setting up networks, and making the information available to people. I mean, I have like a transcript. It's so funny. Intel ops fusion is not spying.
Neil, did you go to Cebu?
Cebu came to us because the militarization and the tensions are running so high. I'm sorry that I can't give you a more exact number of the actual troops. They're there, okay? the current situation following all of these events, and you can see what has sparked the current wave of violence from the massacre down to the aggressions against Camp Bagongdiwa and the inmates of the prison. Just a number of tinderboxes have been lit, and because of most recently last week there was the ferry in Zamboanga Harbor where 30 Filipinos lost their lives because the ferry was blown up. And you have on the one hand you have the MNLF and the community leaders that are saying, what do you expect when these things, when you're raping our wives, when you're coming into our villages and chopping down our crops, when you're decimating our villages, and strafing and terrorizing our people, what do you expect? You're going to have backlash. You're going to have retaliation. But others say that the bombing of the ferry, the blowing up of the ferry, was specifically designed to create yet a further impetus for the RP, for the AFP, Armed Forces of the Philippines, to go in there and further militarize. Because when a ferry blows up and kills 30 people and the government claims it wasn't them that did it, well then, who's going to come in and save the day? Who's going to bring stability to the region? Well, of course, the government stands up and says, we are. And they further go in to secure all of the other interests that are in the region, the plantations, the mining speculators, the oil fields that are in the southern portion of Mindanao. Because of this, we could not go down into Basilan, we could not go down into Sulu. So we did as much of the interviewing as possible with people that they were able to fly out and with people that have already lived through this in Manila. And we conducted our interviews in the metropolitan Manila region.
The lengthy statement that you just read to us, have you gotten any kind of feedback from any international human rights organizations or the press?
The statement is formally going to be published in the fact-finding report, which is going to be submitted to the United Nations probably within the next 3 weeks to a month. Okay, so that will be formally we'll be able to see how the report is received from those that we're going to submit it to. Obviously, the government is refuting most of what the fact-finding missions are stating and what they're saying. They're just saying that, for the most part, these are all allegations and accusations that are blown out of proportion. We did have an audience with a congressional delegation that has agreed to address two issues surrounding the prison, one of which was the fact that from the inmates that were jailed in 2001, there were approximately 20 minors that were incarcerated with the regular inmates. That's a violation of international law. That's also something that made CNN 2 weeks before we arrived, which meant that it was on the radar of Congress. They don't like to be marred in the international media as not, doing anything about the children that are in their prison system. So we sounded like a bit of a broken record on that front. We raised an issue that our friends at CNN had already raised. The second thing that we really pushed hard for, asking for better food at the prison, we did ask, and we were told that that's an uphill battle. What we did really push for was that the visiting hours be changed to allow the families that bring in the food for the inmates at the prison be changed at the cusp of the Ramadan season, because as most of us know, you can't eat from sunup to sundown, and the visiting hours don't coincide with Ramadan, and so that would really force the inmates to eat only what they're being served at Camp Bagang Diwa. So that we still haven't heard, but that seemed more doable, and we might have actually made a dent on that front. So just little things, whatever you can do, right? So.
Yeah, just Neil, I was there at the, I met with the Bustle on 73 in September of 2002, and the conditions were much, much better. They weren't great at that point, but the families lived there with them for a week at a time. They had the use of all the floors. We wandered up and down, and it was all kind of open. So at that point, there was more access for me as a U.S. citizen to detainees in the horrendous, with no charges in the Philippines than to get access to detainees in the United States. So clearly, the situation has deteriorated dramatically. I'm glad you're really pushing on those things. But I was a little unclear that there were some folks that were of the Bustle on 73 that were killed. Were they somehow? Maybe I was just tired. But did that happen in the prison, or were they released? And could you just clarify,
prison itself? It was a prison riot in earlier this year, and it was incited by some of the well, there were 11 that were known to be Abu Sayyaf members. There were over 20 that got killed, and as you saw in the video, the wife of one of those that got killed, and her father, 75 years old, real threat. These Abu Sayyaf, 75-year-olds that are terrorizing. I'm being sarcastic, of course, but there were innocents that died in the retaking of the siege of the jail.
You went into interview the prisoners. It sounds like it's been a huge disparity from 2002 to 2005. Do you sense that it'll degrade even more, and their rights will be violated even more?
I'm not sure how it could degrade much more. It's already besides the prisoners actually dying because of the conditions in the jail. They could be beaten more frequently, I suppose. But it was only, we were denied entry to the jail the first day that we went. The second day, And when we did go, it was because we had gone through congressional channels to make sure that we had proper permits, like all permits in place, that absolutely everything was followed to a T, so that we could get into the jail at that point. I actually stayed for the meeting at the Congress to do the appeal with respect to Ramadan, with respect to the child incarceration, and I was meeting with the Congress people while the other half of the group went to the jail to actually do the interviews at the jail. We had to split because we were supposed to go all as a group the first day to the jail, and they just flat out denied us. They said that that, you know, there was no purpose for us to be there. You know, what good could come of us being there? And used every tactic available. The warden wasn't there, even though the warden's car was sitting out in the parking lot. You know, the attorney for a number of the inmates said, that's the warden's car, you know, but yet they say the warden isn't here. And we waited for 6 hours, 5.5 hours, for somebody to come out. Our spokesperson, the attorney for the inmates, who was supposed to facilitate with the warden our visit. And it died that day. We weren't able to do it. So we left and we went back, you know, to that night. Then the next day we split, and half of us went to do the Congress visit. The other half went to the jail. So, you know, long answer to a short question. I don't know how much worse things can get. We did our best to just make known how bad things are. We also did what we could to try and make things that much better.
Yeah.
Besides the attorney that was sort of talking about the situations, how is the little sort of the representation for the prisoners? Is there just one attorney who's going there to help them out, or how does that work?
There are more than one attorney. There was only one that we were specifically dealing with, and she represents quite a number of them. I don't know exactly how many, more than 10.
Have they been charged with anything?
What's that?
But you said they're not actually been charged with anything.
Some have not been charged. Some have been charged, and they have not yet had a trial, which is another issue, you know. So they've some that have been charged have been sitting there for over 2 years without having any sort of trial. Those would be the ones that the attorneys are representing. But some of them are sitting there and they don't even know. They still don't know what they're in there for. Well, they can suppose what they're in there for. It's because, as they claim, they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. They were rounded up as part of an onslaught by the local authorities to tackle the Abu Sayyaf problem. But there were over 400 in that blitz that the same thing happened to. So, any other questions?
No. Well,
or discussion,
one
commentary?
One point on that, a number of them, when I talked to them in 2002, said that it was like some neighbor had a grudge against them. And so one person had visited a relative in Saudi Arabia. So the next thing I know, they had a small business, and the person next, the other small business down the road said, well, that guy's Abu Sayyaf. And it was really that kind of just somebody had a grudge, or someone was a teacher, and they were picked up on their motorcycle when they were, like, working part-time as a taxi, you know, driver around the edges. So a lot of them said, you know, we're in, as you said, in the wrong place. And that's why it's like there's no reason from the government's perspective ostensibly to like keep this going. It just is awful. But I had a question about the whole impeachment thing. I don't want to necessarily change, but I did want to ask that with the people power, Jessica, what your sense of like the next steps? You said it was like 5 months for Estrada and you know, a number of years in terms of mobilizing, of where your sense of things, you know, from different groups you've talked with of people mobilizing, given that this climate of like targeting a human rights lawyers and clergy and others, union organizers, that are being killed?
Well, I've been in the U.S. for the past 4 weeks, so I've been keeping in touch through email and reading the newspapers online, etc. But what I picked up on the other day in some statements that came across email, I know that throughout July, because former President Aquino had in early July, she, you know, made a call to President Arroyo to step down, to resign. And that came right after that. The Makati Business Club also made a similar statement. So people felt that this really was the moment, because these were some big guns, excuse the expression, that had come out and, you know, made this call. But Gloria held tight. And what I was told was there had been, in terms of like massive street protests and mobilization, organizations were not able to get the numbers that they wanted in the streets, because around that time there was some tensions between Aquino's group and former President Estrada's people or forces, because, you know, of course different political forces are going to take advantage of these kinds of moments. And so people in Estrada's camp saw this as the opportunity for him to reclaim the throne that was stolen from him in 2001, etc. So Aquino's folks, you know, they had kind of laid this hard line that was, well, we will not join any activities that involve Estrada forces. If it was just like progressive movement or political opposition, they would be there. But Estrada, you know, they were joining anyone and everyone. And so, you know, there were those sort of negotiations that were going on that were preventing like really massive street protests, although it did reach, you know, a couple hundred thousand, etc. Recently over, I got an email that I just kind of skimmed, unfortunately, but it was talking about this alliance of now Aquino, Estrada, the political opposition, etc. So it seems like some of those tensions have been set aside for the time being in order to, you know, help the groundswell of people's protests. So I think what we'll see are ongoing actions in the street. I think activities like the International Solidarity Mission also gave some additional oomph, because I know a lot of the delegates are returning to their respective countries and working through their various parliamentary systems or the Commission on Human Rights at the UN to put political pressure from those angles onto President Arroyo. So, you know, I'm not sure. I'm not that great of a political analyst that I can say, well, by March 2006, you know, she'll be gone or something. But I think that you'll see, because the other thing that's happening now is the expanded value-added tax that I mentioned earlier. It was originally supposed to be implemented June 30th, but the Supreme Court issued a temporary restraining order because, I mean, people were already angry about this whole political scandal that broke up about the cheating in the elections and really hurting economically with the increase in bus fare and rice and everything else. So, you know, the EVAT was temporarily postponed, its implementation. Now the temporary restraining order has been lifted and will soon be postponed. I know I got an email about a transport strike that was planned, a nationwide transport strike, to coincide with the implementation of the new taxes. So all of this will add, especially the economic issues, will add fuel to the fire to really get, you know, hundreds of thousands out into the streets in the next few months. That's what I say. From the desk? Yes.
But with that, I mean, and maybe you addressed this in your presentation, I apologize for being late, but what, so if Aquino and Estrada are joining this groundswell, I mean, what do we expect even if she does get ousted? I mean, what kind of, are we just going to end up with another person in there that's going to be another puppet to the U.S. government? I mean, what is the solution here, you know?
That's a question that a lot of people have, and from the very beginning, a lot of analysts were saying, you know, this situation is different from others, in that with Marcos, it was clear that Aquino would be the successor. With Estrada, Arroyo was acceptable to, you know, the various political elite that were involved. Who now will replace Gloria? Because her vice president is a former newscaster who also is in the midst of his main... what do you call it, opposing candidate in the elections last year has filed a protest with the Presidential Election Tribunal or something like that, you know, alleging that he also was involved in massive fraud in last year's election. So in terms of his legitimacy, it's also in question. And he's also unacceptable to a lot of, like, the middle class and professionals because he's this newscaster, and he's still... When he speaks, he still talks like he's giving some news report, you know? Then, you know, questions were, would it be the Senate president, you know, who then would be the next successor? So what is being proposed now? Because the people are also saying, yeah, exactly your point. We don't want just somebody else who's just going to be the same, you know? So what's being proposed now is a transition council. So a body that would sort of obviously be a transition body for 1 month or for 1 year or 6 months to a year, consisting of representatives from basic sectors of workers, farmers, and those political forces that were involved in the removal of Gloria from office. And the platform of this, or the work of this transition council, would be to implement immediate economic reforms. So one would be like repealing the implementation of these new taxes, also repudiating debts that are you know, from the Marcos era or other questionable debts to, you know, international financial institutions. Prosecuting human rights violators, etc. Along those lines, immediate reforms. And also setting the stage then for another election in which the next leader would be elected. Another key aspect of the transition council is that it's part of its platform would be on like upholding national sovereignty and democracy, like democratic principles within the leadership. Is that?
What kind of, I mean, I'm just kind of curious as to, like, how, you know, like, I mean, so they're saying that there's going to be an election at the end of this. I mean, I guess maybe that last part that you talked about, you know, this democracy part or figuring out some kind of system in that. But I just still think that I'm just kind of skeptical about, you know, if this is going to solve, I'm obviously not going to solve everything, but how is this going to solve a lot of the systemic problems that have been occurring continually in the Philippines? And, you know, I'm kind of skeptical as to, you know, Estrada and Aquino getting behind this. You know, are they behind the transitional government? You know, and how far behind are they? And everyone else, and especially, like, the big political families in the Philippines. You know, but that's just my comments on it. So.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's you're definitely right that it's not going to solve the systemic problems, but it's a step in that process. I think if a transition council did take shape, that would be that would be pretty significant historic. I mean, that's a precedent that's being set right there, that through a popular movement, some sort of power sharing council could be set up, you know. I think it also continues to add strength and morale to a progressive people's movement, you know. But you're absolutely right that it's not a be-all, end-all solution. In terms of Aquino and everybody else, how are they behind this or not? A lot of different kinds of transition councils have been proposed. Some call it a caretaker government. Some have called it other things, you know. So I think that those are some of the behind-the-scenes conversations and negotiations and wheeling and dealing that are going on now. Because in essence, it would be some sort of power-sharing thing. But the progressive movement wants to ensure that the voice of the most oppressed sectors is there on the transition council.
I wouldn't be surprised if this transition council or caretaker government is an idea of the CIA or the ruling elite. One, it's a total violation of the Constitution. There is a succession apparatus. If somebody's ousted, and it's a smokescreen to save GMA from impeachment. Really, it's working. It is working. And I'm blanking out on the name of the vice president. Whatever charges they're throwing at him is, of course, to smear him. One, Nolly De Castro, he was an investigative journalist in the Philippines. He was. He wouldn't have been elected vice president if he wasn't popular with the people. He was popular with the people. And somehow, I appreciate that you went there, but there is also, you know, this cultural thing that we must also know where people are coming from in the Philippines, why they are doing things the way they are doing. And really, let him throw GMA and whoever is next. That's the Constitution. And that's democracy. And then we deal with it. Well, let's see him.
Some have argued for that, and then there have also been analysis that if the constitutional succession is followed, that De Castro won't last long, which may be the case. And some have also argued, like Gloria has continually used the whole constitutional argument to discourage the popular movement that's calling for her ouster, saying this is unconstitutional. But there are lawyers who have defended this, saying, no, it's inherent in the Constitution that if the government is no longer competent to govern, then the people have, you know, inherent in the people's right to get rid of that government and put one in place that will serve its interests. I was going to say something else regarding your point, but it slips my mind.
About the possibility of a CIA involvement in the Transition Council, I don't know, but it does not connect to an article at the Filipino Express where the U.S. ambassador in the Philippines said they have, you know, total confidence, you know, in President Arroyo.
Exactly.
And that, you know, they would support any constitutional means to change, you know, to change her, but, you know, will use any means under their power to fight unconstitutional means, which means coup d'etat and people power. So I don't know if, you know, I think the U.S. is contented with Gloria being power.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe they would not support the Transition Council.
That's the idea. That's the Transition Council is a smear, is a cloud, you know, that was thrown in so that it discredits succession and keep GMA. It's exactly that.
That's what I forgot earlier. Actually, there was another proposal that was made in this whole political concept that came from former President Fidel Ramos, who is known to be very close to the United States and to GME. And his proposal, and he went to the presidential palace and made this proposal at night, and he and GMA shook hands, and GMA said nothing. But what his proposal was charter change, which over which GMA would be the sort of transitional leader over this process of charter change. And then after which there would be, you know, election, because there's this whole idea to shift to a parliamentary system with prime minister, etc. This was really interpreted more along what you're saying as an easy exit or a graceful exit for GMA, that she could serve out, you know, another 10 months or so as this transition president and gracefully exit as a new form of government was, you know, ushered in. I hear your point about the transition council. I think there are some groups that are proposing similar things under different names that that are meant to sort of distract from things. I think there are other large political forces, particularly in the progressive movement, that have built up a reputation over, you know, years of struggle, that they're not, you know, being infiltrated or led by the CAA, and I think that's a genuine proposal on their part to prevent the kind of situation where you have another leader come in and there's this cosmetic change of, you know, leadership that doesn't really address any of the immediate needs of the people. So I want to add that about Ramos's proposal.
Dave? Yeah, I think we've got to put together what we saw earlier in terms of there's really de facto martial law in most of the country, with all the debate about the legalities in Manila, really that's where it's concentrated. But, you know, the army isn't bothering with legalities. When they go in there, they just execute people on the spot. And once they're dead, then they say they're Abu Sayyaf, or they're NPA, or they're Moro Islamic Liberation Front. Whoever is opposing them, they just kill them. And the military, if they really felt threatened in the city, they would be the first ones to declare martial law or stage a coup. So I think the real question is, what is going to strengthen the people's movement the most out of this? And what's going to weaken the government the most? You know? Because that, whatever builds the most unity among all the different opposition forces is going to create more space to organize. It's going to strengthen all the people's movements. And it will strengthen the revolutionary forces out in the countryside who are confronting the army. And they're the only defense the people in the countryside have. And that has to be the movement that will eventually bring down the system. And I really agree with your question. We have to look at what... Do we just want to go around on a treadmill? And there are people in the Philippines who have a strategy to actually... To deal with the system that's bringing all this suffering down on people.
Can you give us a background, a quick background on the International Solidarity Mission?
The International Solidarity Mission was organized by a number of progressive organizations in the Philippines with the intent of fact-finding in specific hotspots or regions of the country of the Philippines. So one of the regions is the southern Philippines, Mindanao, specifically Sulu and Basilan. Another was the eastern Visayas, Samar. We could go on for hours commenting on what the specific issues are in each of the regions. I'm just naming them. Another one was the island of Mindoro, which has been heavily militarized as well. And then there was Central Luzon, which is the northernmost island of the Philippines. That was the fourth, and then the fifth was specifically Hacienda Luisita, which is a plantation that that has had some very specific problems in the last 2 years with respect to unionization, workers, and workers' rights. So these areas, these regions were specific focus areas for the International Solidarity Mission, and then delegates came from, see if I can name, we had Canada, the United States, Japan, India, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, to name a few. And all of these delegates then, most of them got a chance to actually say what region they wanted to go to. Others that didn't choose were suggested insofar as a team that they would go to engage and actually listen to the stories of the people and hear what the human rights violations and abuses have been that have made these such hot spots in the country, and then take these the documentation, the photographs, the stories, the tapes, the film back and write the reports that are going to be compiled and assembled, and get the word out, because we hear the defense, the counter argument to all of these stories every day. That's the story of the government. That's the story of the you know, the military. This is what they say. You know, everything that they say is in defense of their actions. They're the perpetrators, for the most part, of the stuff that is going wrong in these regions. It's very important that at least once in a while the voice of the people is heard. And so the international delegates, in conjunction with the Filipinos that are working hard to ensure that these things are prevented or at least documented, get together and in one voice put together a report that can go outside the bounds of the Philippines. We all take these stories with us when we leave. I can only hope that in my case personally, that I can share one iota of the things that I heard and do justice to the people that were sharing with me, so that all of you can then take these stories and get the word out to others, so that we're not such a naive culture about what's going on outside of our own backyard.
And when was this initiative started?
The Solidarity Mission was in the planning stages for over a year and a half. Many of us found out about it about a year ago. We had, through NISPOP, we fielded
eight
candidates that went over from New York and participated in the ISM. And so each of the eight are doing their own sort of engaging and educating, and they'll be sharing what they learned when they come back as well, similar to what I'm doing. And then, of course, the main report, the consolidation of what was learned, that will be submitted beyond the Philippines to at least make known that somebody has listened to the other side.
We wanted to take up a collection because Jessica is going back to the Philippines next week, and our dollars, of course, go a really long way in the Philippines, so if you could donate to In Peace Mindanao, it's
the whatever money that you feel you want to share will go to Initiatives for Peace in Mindanao, which is a Mindanao-wide organization. It describes itself as a grassroots movement for creating initiatives for peace. And it, In Peace Mindanao was founded in late 2003. It was sparked by there had been an all-out war launched in the autonomous region of Muslim Mindanao in early 2003. A couple months later, there was a bombing at the international airport in Davao City, and then another bombing a month later at the wharf in Davao City. So Initiatives for Peace in Mindanao came together at a conference, or was born out of a conference that was attended by people from various sectors, everywhere from local government officials to lawyers, teachers, people's organizations, who were looking for answers and longer-term solutions to development issues and et cetera. So In Peace Mindanao works on everything from issues surrounding large-scale mining in the Philippines to they have fact-finding and mercy mission to Sulu. That the documentary was actually made from the fact-finding that In Peace Mindanao organized in Sulu. They have women's groups, youth groups. They've now started a lawyers for peace in Mindanao formation, etc. So, good organization to support.
So, thank you to Neil and Jessica, and please take a flyer and hopefully come out if you can on Thursday at the UN and in DC in a couple weeks at the 24th. Thank you. Yay.